Coming up, we analyze Pope Francis's new document on the family. Plus, Judy Valente on clergy and others trying to hold back the spreading violence of gangs and guns in Chicago. Also, ushers, church doorkeepers who set the tone for Sunday worship.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Pope Francis and Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, the spiritual leader of Eastern Orthodox Christians, will be making a joint visit to Greece next week to highlight Europe's escalating migrant crisis. The Vatican said the April 16th visit will draw attention to the desperate situation faced by many migrants and refugees. The two leaders said they hope their visit will demonstrate a sense of solidarity and responsibility among all Christians. They'll be traveling to the Greek island of Lesbos, which has become a major flashpoint in the crisis. Since the beginning of this year, more than 170,000 migrants from the Middle East, Asia, and Africa have made their way to Greece. Tens of thousands are stranded there after several other European nations closed their borders to refugees. Pope Francis made news on another front this week. On Friday, the Vatican released his much-anticipated document on the family called Amoris Laetitia, Latin for the joy of love. Francis addressed a broad range of challenges facing families and urged the Catholic Church to be less judgmental on the complexities of family life. He did not make any explicit changes to church teaching, as some had hoped, on the hot-button issue of whether divorced Catholics who are remarried should be allowed to receive communion. He appeared to urge discernment and reliance on individual consciences. Joining me now with more about the document is our managing editor, Kim Lawton, and Reverend Tom Reese, senior analyst at National Catholic Reporter. Welcome to you both. Tom, what's the heart of this document?
I think it's a long document, and what I recommend to people is they go immediately to chapter 3, because there the Pope gives this beautiful meditation on St. Paul's hymn about love. Love is patient, love is kind, and applies it to the life and the love of a couple. And I think this would be a great read for people preparing for marriage and people who have been married 10, 20, 30 years. I think it's a real encouragement. It's a real inspiration.
Of course, a lot of people were hoping, expecting maybe there would be some really big shifts. Was there a big change in what the Pope said, especially when it comes to divorced Catholics who've been remarried outside the church?
Well, that's a very interesting one, because the rigorous, the conservatives, wanted the Pope to come in and say, hey, they broke the rules, no communion, period. As opposed to the pastoral, you know, people who wanted to say, hey, everybody should be welcome. He doesn't take either position. He says we have to look at each concrete situation. We have to bring people to, you know, together to discern and to discuss it, and then decide what they should do.
But that's a kind of a trademark now for the Pope, isn't it? I mean, you put out something that's kind of vague and see what happens.
Well, I think, you know, what he's trying to do is to really respond to the reality of the people who are struggling with it. You know, there's no abstract family. There's no ideal family. And he's tired of the church being judgmental and laying down rules. Instead, he wants us to walk with these couples with compassion, treat them as Jesus would treat them.
Mm-hmm. A lot of people were surprised by that. You know, it's not a bunch of rules and that kind of language in this document. I have gotten a lot of statements from advocates for gay people who were disappointed. Nobody, I think, realistically expected this pope was going to bless same-sex unions, but they were disappointed in some of his language.
Well, I think, actually, the document says very little about gays, which, of course, may be a disappointment in itself for some. He was never going to say, let's bless gay marriages. But I think what he says about being welcoming, being compassionate, being understanding, and being accepting, and also seeing the grace that is in people's lives, no matter what kind of a relationship they're in, as long as they're loving and kind and committed, that God can be present there.
And who benefits the most from this?
Well, obviously families. And I think divorced families, I think it's going to be very important for them. And of course, that touches everybody. Everybody has a friend or a relative who's divorced and remarried. But, you know, families need help. They need compassion. They need understanding. And that's changing the church in that direction is a major agenda item for this pope.
Making it more pastoral.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And just very briefly, along those lines, people were remarking on the fact that the Pope in this document urged young couples to kiss each other and share chores and had some practical advice, too.
Yeah, he's very practical. He says, you know, you should always say, please, I'm sorry, and thank you. The three words that should be said all the time in a family.
And it, some of those words need to be said right now, I'm sorry. Thanks to Kim Lawton and to Father Tom Rees. It's good to see you again.
Good to be with you.
In other news, the Vatican is investigating allegations that two executives from a children's hospital misappropriated funds. The money was allegedly used to pay for the apartment renovation of the Vatican's former Secretary of State. The two executives are accused of taking $455,000 belonging to Rome's Bambino Gesù Children's Hospital. Former Secretary of State Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone has insisted he paid for the apartment renovations himself and that the $170,000 he recently donated to the Children's Hospital was voluntary and not a reimbursement. Here at home, more controversy over the treatment of gays. Mississippi's governor has signed legislation that allows churches, religious charities, and privately held businesses to decline services to gays if that would violate their religious beliefs. Some states, including Vermont, Washington, and New York, have responded by banning state-sponsored travel to Mississippi. The new law is expected to take effect in July. Meanwhile, PayPal has announced that it has dropped plans to build a global operations center in Charlotte because of a new state law. North Carolina passed a requirement that transgender people use bathrooms based on the gender listed on their birth certificates. PayPal had pledged to invest $3.6 million in the region. Now, part two of Judy Valente's report on gun violence in Chicago, where there have been more than 800 shootings this year, many of them causing the deaths of children. Judy examines the heartbreak of the mothers and families of children killed or locked up because of gun violence, and the heroism of a juvenile judge, police, and clergy working to try to help them.
A Saturday morning at the Catholic Precious Blood Ministry of Reconciliation on Chicago's South Side. Mothers from across the city gather for a healing circle led by Sister Donna Liette.
We have Damon's picture there and Jimmy's, two of our young boys in the neighborhood who were recently, lives were taken by violence.
Most of these women here have children who were either killed or are in prison. They begin with a poem titled, Stop.
Stop the killing, the drug dealing, and the gang banging. Stop the tears from falling from our mother's eyes. Stop the pain that's in our mother's hearts.
And then each mother tells her story.
There are shoes that my son wore, and he was a victim of gun violence in the Kenwood community. and that was about 2.5 years ago.
They took my son's life for no reason whatsoever. He wasn't gangbanging.
My son is serving life in prison for a crime he committed when he was 15. He's now 36. So even though I lost him to gun violence on the other side.
The Precious Blood Ministry of Reconciliation also offers support to the other victims of gun violence, the survivors.
I come to the circle hurt, but I come angry. Because I feel like my nephew didn't have a chance. He just made 19 in December, just celebrated a birthday. Because I don't know how people could go through without faith, without God.
Father Dave Kelly is the ministry's director. He says the center tries to be a place of what he calls radical hospitality.
Accompaniment is walking alongside. It's very much a biblical kind of thing of just accompanying someone on the journey, being there on that journey. Not necessarily do I know where we're going, but I'm committed to you as a human being, and I'm going to be there for you.
We have communities and families that are super saturated with the experience of violence over multiple generations.
Reverend Susan Johnson is an American Baptist minister. She runs a program called Chicago Survivors.
We'll go with them to the medical examiner's office to identify the body. We'll talk with the police, with them, just to give them that security that they're not just at large in the midst of this crisis.
Among the hardest cases to handle are incidents of random violence. Louise Buchner's husband, John, was gunned down while he was unloading groceries from a car by a teenager who rode by their home on a bicycle.
It has changed me forever. My family will never be the same again. You know, when someone come and take a life from you like that for no reason.
Jay Sheree Williams saw the father of her three children gunned down last year at their home by an acquaintance in front of her four-year-old daughter.
It's like she's a newborn baby all over again. So, you know, she just want to be hugged and loved on, and now want to be reassured that my life is not going to be taken away.
I think we grossly underestimate the impact on children in urban neighborhoods where they grow up with an awareness of violence, with a personal experience of violence. When we look at children who are not performing well in school, whose attendance isn't good at school, we should ask ourselves, where's the trauma in this child's life and how can we intervene?
Williams did not want to remain with her children in the home where the shooting occurred. For months, she found herself moving from one relative's or friend's apartment to another. Chicago Survivors proved the one constant in her life.
They provided counseling. They also took me around to take care of a lot of business that I wasn't able to do and I was afraid to get on the bus and do.
No arrests have been made so far in either the Buchner or Williams shootings. Father Kelly, the juvenile detention center chaplain, says even if suspects were arrested, incarceration is only a partial answer at best to curbing the violence.
There's a lot of research that will say that it does more harm than good. And what it does as well, because it is so costly, is it takes from the community. So the resources that we need in this community, good schools, I mean really good schools, mental health, jobs, those are non-existent because of the cost factor, if you will, for incarceration.
Kelly says there are other ways to hold kids accountable for their actions, especially those involved in nonviolent crimes. He's a proponent of an alternative known as restorative justice.
Basically, I look at crime or violence as a violation of relationships. People are harmed. People do that harm. Restorative justice is to repair as best we can those relationships.
I think it seeks answers as to why someone has done something. If you know why you've done something, then you can go about changing behavior.
Kelly has gained a powerful ally in Cook County Juvenile Judge Colleen Sheehan. Sheehan says she realized in her first year in juvenile court that she needed to look for innovative ways to rescue kids from the cycle of violence.
When I came to juvenile court, after the first year, there was a tally of 5 children who were on my probation that had been murdered. By the second year, the number had risen to 12. It had a big effect on me, you know, sort of kind of like, hey, what's going on here and what are we doing about this?
Sheehan began looking at alternatives to traditional courts. She's proposed establishing a series of restorative justice community courts. Instead of a traditional courtroom, young defendants would go to a place like the Precious Blood Center for Reconciliation and participate in a peace circle, similar to the ones already held for mothers struggling with the death of a child. Both Kelly and Sheehan say a key component of restorative justice is that community members must be involved.
If it's going to be a sustained effort, it cannot be a policing strategy. It's got to be a community strategy. It's got to be a community kind of coming together and really dealing with the issues.
Sheehan already has ordered juvenile defendants to attend restorative justice peace circles. She's even convened peace circles for police and teens. She admits she was surprised by the reaction she got from a young defendant in her courtroom when she proposed the idea.
I said, would you be interested in sitting with the police in a safe space, not invested in being a victim or blaming, but actually invested in solution? What if I gave you credit towards those community service hours? I said, would you be interested in doing something like that? And then he just looked at me, he stood back, he looked at me, and he said, I'll do it for free.
Police Lieutenant Laurel Bresnahan, shown here in a video made after the event, was at first skeptical.
She sort of flipped the tables and she asked us as police officers how we felt when we interacted with the community, some of the things that we dealt with. And I thought, well, wow, maybe somebody's actually going to listen to what we have to say as well, which was a very kind of a empowering thing.
One thing that I'm going to take away from today is to be more understanding, you know, to see everyone as not just a uniform.
There were police officers who said, I'm sorry. There were children who said they were sorry. There were real connections going on.
In another of her initiatives, Sheehan sponsored a photography contest for police and teens called Bridging the Divide. It was another idea that sprang from her courtroom experience.
I had to be here because of support. I knew I had support here.
Nearly all who work with those whose lives have been affected by violence say it is a deeply spiritual experience.
I talk about the compassion that we see in the community of survivors, the fellow feeling, the empathy, and the forgiveness. It comes out of a spiritual searching that people who haven't had a firsthand experience don't have to go through.
Sometimes it feels as if I keep trying to do things different and trying to push innovative ideas because I see something that's in front of me and I feel compelled to act. And sometimes it feels like there's a certain divinity that happens.
My work is in between Good Friday, which is the death, and Easter. Too often as Christians, we want to move from Good Friday to Easter and we forget about Holy Saturday, which is the real place of the work of the church. Because most of us, most people, are living in the shadows of the crucifixion, wanting that resurrection, wanting that new life, that freedom, that liberation, but not there yet. And we work in this Holy Saturday moment.
It is that hope of something better that continues to inspire survivors and those working to stop the violence. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Judy Valente in Chicago.
For many pilgrims, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem is one of the holiest sites in Christianity. Worshippers believe it was built on the site of the tomb from which Jesus was resurrected. Over the centuries, different branches of Christianity have kept jealous watch over the site, sometimes fighting over who controlled what. Gradually, the shrine inside the church, marking the tomb, deteriorated. Finally, it was so near collapse, some of the church rivals came to agreement. A $3.4 million renovation is set to begin next month. Earlier this week, Pope Francis blessed the eyes of a 5-year-old girl from Ohio. Elizabeth Myers, Lizzie, was born with a rare genetic disease that has already caused significant hearing loss and will eventually rob her of both her hearing and her sight. On a visual bucket list Lizzie's parents created for their daughter before she goes blind, seeing the Pope. On Wednesday, Lizzie and her family got their wish. They had special seats at Francis's general audience, and the Pope blessed the little girl. Lizzie's parents are Catholics and are hoping for a miracle. On our calendar, the Hindu Picture Festival began in central India. The festival is celebrated once every 12 years at one of four different Indian cities. Thousands of Hindus gather to bathe in holy rivers, which they believe will cleanse them of sin. And Sikhs celebrate one of their most important holidays, Vaisakhi. Often observed as a harvest festival, the day also marks the time in the 17th century when Sikhs first identified themselves as a group. Many Hindus also observe Vaisakhi as a time of renewal and rebirth. We have a belief and practice segment today on the spirit, discipline, and responsibilities of ushers, honored, highly trained doorkeepers who are the first persons many churchgoers of all denominations encounter on Sunday mornings. They also help create and maintain the spirit of worship, as we discovered at Hemingway Memorial AME Church in District Heights, Maryland. Our guide was Charles Brown, a member of the church's senior usher board and one of the 15,000 members of the National United Church Ushers Association of America.
The ushers normally arrive at least a half an hour before the beginning of the service. The ushers serves as the forerunner for the service. In essence, they prepare the church for the parishioners.
Dear Lord, we want to thank you for waking us up this morning and starting us on our way.
They would place the bulletins in the proper places, especially on the choir loft or the pulpit. They would check the pews to see if there are collection envelopes available. Once the service starts, everything is in place for Krishna and the guests. Hemingway is part of the National United Church Arts Association of America Incorporated. We practice our training at the School of Ushering. We only use signs and signals to communicate in the service. There's very little talking going on among the ushers. Once the parishioners arrive at church, they are greeted by a usher at the door with a smile, welcoming them to the Hemingway Church and extending to them a program and offering them a seat. It is important to have a certain personality or a demeanor that will be inviting to that parishioner or guest, because you never know who is coming in through your doors. And the first person that they meet will be an usher. Once service starts, we try to seat all visiting guests or any parishioners towards the front and move towards the back, so that any late parishioners or guests which arrive do not necessarily disrupt the service by going up to the front. We normally have ushers on in aisles from 15 to 20 minutes, depending on the number of ushers that you have serving that day. Because of our aisles are narrow, the ushers turn their back to the wall to allow for the relieving ushers to come to stand behind them. Being a church usher is important because an usher keeps order and decorum within the service. As an usher, you just need to be focused and always cognizant of what's going on in the service. I don't know if anyone who have attended a service would actually notice that when an usher is on duty, and even when they are going through the prayer position, their eyes are never closed. They always have the head bow, but they always are surfacing the congregation, because you never know when someone, one, may be ill, or something other incident may be occurring, and it is your duty to protect that congregation. Being an usher on duty and being also a parishioner to me is a dual function. It is not unusual to see an usher who are on duty to get involved in the service, because the Spirit will flow anywhere at any time. You always have to be cognizant as an usher in the aisles, so you try not to be overwhelmed. However, if you're overwhelmed by the Spirit, there's nothing which you can do but just let it go, and just let the usher in charge would send a relief down to your position. I am an usher because God has given me that talent, and He also has given me a blessing to be a blessing to others.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's much more on our website. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.